before, could you just explain before I get into this, where we actually are situated within the United Kingdom? As you can see, London's here, Scotland, where it rains a lot, is up there, and Bristol is here, right on the Severn Channel. And you can see, as we spoke about the slave trade, what an important port it would have been for the hinterland of the United Kingdom. Bristol, in the period I was speaking about, which is the 18th century, was the second largest city in the UK in economic importance as well as population. Not only the slave trade, Bristol was prominent in the sugar industry, armaments industry, shipbuilding, a whole host of things. And one of the biggest biggest influences on Bristol was a very large coal field that was situated on, which we're going to see any second now.
I thought you wanted that.
No, coal field, big question. Sorry about that. Okay, the Kingswood Forest, which I'm going to speak about today, is where this coal field is situated. It's the red here. So if you remember, Bristol's here, it is the Severn Channel. And there is the Kingswood coal field. See, we've got other large coal fields here, but this coal field here actually supported Bristol in its early industrial development. It was very important for glass making, for the brass industry, the cannons that were made in Bristol were shipped all over the world. The Kingswood Forest here was also, as the name suggests, a massive area of woodland. This was demised over the period I'm going to be talking about, because once again, as I said, shipbuilding, a lot of the actual trees were cut down before the shipbuilding. But I'm going to jump back in time now to the time of William the Bastard, as he was known by his contemporaries, or William the Conqueror, more likely known in today's history books. As you know, he landed around here in 1066 with his mercenary army and quickly spread over the country. In 1087, we've got the Domesday Book together. And the important thing about the Domesday Book in British culture, it passed the land off. People started to own land. Just about everything, every sheep, field, was documented for the purpose of taxation and also state as well. But another important thing, all the forests, and there's Kingswood Forest here, there's Chatham up here, there's lots of different forests, but Crown property, made Crown property. And one of the most important things about this is it became like, I suppose, a holiday park for the monarchs. They could go down there, they would travel out with all their courtiers and such like, and go hunting for game. And what I mean by game, I mean deer, mainly. And they would hunt the game, they'd set up wardens that would look after the game when the king wasn't there, or queen, whatever the case might be. And basically, they would keep an eye on the forest and make sure it was well stocked with game, and it was in good order. But as you can see, I mean, the coal field roughly is around the size of the forest. It's a large expanse of land. And we've all heard about people in history, like Robin Hood, for example. It was a magnet for outlaws. You know, if you were outlaws from the legal system, for one reason or another, a lot of people would escape to the forests to meet with like-minded people, and they would squat the land there. Now, squatting is very interesting. Have you all heard about common lands? You know what I'm speaking about? I speak about common land. Basically, it's still owned land, but it was land that wasn't actually utilised by the ruling class of that particular area. And people could utilise the stuff on the land for a whole various reasons. They could take wood for building and for fuel, etc. Get berries. They could raise their sheep or their oxen or their horses on there. But one of the most important things that I found about common land, that's a very quick synopsis, by the way. There's lots and lots of books written about common land, but one of the most important things about it is a lot of it was handed down for a generation by word of mouth. There's not a great deal written down about it. But one of the most important things I feel about common land is the people who actually worked and used the commons held the key to sustainability. So, for example, if you suddenly brought a couple of new cows and you wanted to graze them on the common land, you might be refused for the simple reason that it would not be able to sustain those extra cows that were thrown the common land out. And that is something I believe that we've lost in the current age. That's what we need to reclaim. It's our ownership of the land. It's our ownership of the land. It's our ownership of the land. Another interesting thing about the common land is the one-day house. Has anybody ever heard about the one-day house? Thank you, Roger. He's been to other talks before. The one-day house I read about this first off of an anarchist historian, Colin Walls, who writes a lot about housing and such like. And once again, there's evidence of this in Peru, Italy, South Wales, but also Kingswood. And it's not written down anyway. And there's different ideas around the rights to it. But in Kingswood, if you could get a structure up, four walls and smoke coming out of the chimney or the hearth, between dusk to dawn, then you could claim that land. Now, evidently, what you would need, you would need some sort of community help there. You could not. It would be physically impossible for you to build some structure in that period of time, unless it's very small, I suppose, unless you can stand up. So you get all your mates to come down, your family, your lineage, but the next slide looks like that. Your lineage will come and help you. This is a map of Kingswood Forest, and all these places here are all little spotted cottages, because you've been large space both. And I'll just like, I've got the names here, and there's a couple we can pick out. Sam and Thomas Potter, for example. You've got stones dotted around here. There's Edward's stone up here, sandstone here, jazz stone here. So you can see there's evidence of lineage. I mean, there's, in fact, if you have a good look at this, which I have, there's the fries up here, for example, there might be some fries up there. They're dotted about. But another very interesting thing about the common land, sorry, about the Bundy house, is one of the famous stories, how you actually claim the land around it that you can work. And one of the stories I have heard is what you do, I mean, don't forget all your mates to turn up, you build this house, we drink inside as we build it, you know, things. And you don't have the walls before you went like that, you fresh through the night. But in the morning, what you do to claim the land, you stand with your back to the wall, you get an axe, and you throw it. And as far as you could throw it, you'd mark out your land around. You can imagine the ranger of the forest trotting along the hills, hears this noise, comes round the corner, and there's all this gang of people, and now suddenly pops out of nowhere. Shall I say something? Then he notices some bloke swinging an axe around with all his drunken mates. Well, I think he would just probably move on. Which brings me to the next point. I mean, as you know, the English Revolution of 1649, where we lost Charlie's head off, Charlie Stuart, and the Crown lost authority within, evidently, there was the military dictatorship of the major generals. Once again, I'm speeding through this. But like, when the monarchy was reasserted on us in 1660, one of the first things that Charles II, Charles Stuart II, wanted was to reassert his authority. And we had this bright idea of coming up to Kingswood and reasserting his authority up there, as in other forests. But Kingswood had developed a lot. I mean, I found evidence of spotting going back to 1585, which was probably spotted before that, but that was when I first found the written records and the Bristol records of this. But, of course, after the English Civil War, there was a lot of discontent, the New Modern Army, the Burford uprising, the Putney debates. A lot of the New Modern Army were wondering what on earth they fought for, you know, where's the money, a lot of them hadn't been paid. And I suppose some of you know that, unfortunately, I mean, this is a stain on our history, is a lot of the army were transported over to Ireland, where they fought in Cromwell's armies, the Battle of Drogheda, and such like, you know, where they got the land in part payment for wages. But a lot of them shipped out from Bristol. Now there's no doubt that a lot of them legged it, deserted, didn't fancy anymore, they've had enough, had enough school. And I believe the spotting did take off. A lot of them ended up here. There was already settlements up here. I think a lot of them came up here. I mean, the Kingswood Forest was still very big. But there was a lot of room for them to move into. And in 1670, after the King the Second, Charles II reasserted, or tried to reassert his authority, he sent a few people up to reassert his authority over the forest. And one thing about, I'll go on to the rights in a minute, but like, obviously the Scotsers didn't want this authority, they were quite happy living where they wanted. But there's a very funny story, actually, I love this one. He had this bright idea among these fellows, and thought, I know what I'd do to reassert the King's authority. I restocked the forest with game. So he got he got 12 deers, 6 stags, 6 hinds, and let them go. So off they trotted, and 2 days later he came back, and surprise, surprise, they're all gone. You know, they'd all been eaten. And the ones who hadn't eaten were falling down coal mines, you know. It's a bit like throwing pork pies at striking miners, and this will get rid of them. You know, it just didn't work, it just didn't work. And in 1670, then tried force, and they were beaten comprehensively. And after that, until the appearance, I'm going to talk about the mid-18th century, there was no royal authority over here. You see, the liberties here, I'm not going to go too much about it. For all intents and purposes, these were big squatters. These were people who sort of had rough ownership. I mean, there was legal battles going on right up to the 19th, 20th century over some of the land holdings here. These people were squatted. They'd also allowed other squatters, separate squatters and such like. Now, I spoke about the benefits of common land, you know, grazing animals and such like. One of the most important things about the Kings of Christ, I mean, talk about the miners, was the coal. So not only could they get the wood and such like, but they could start digging. Literally, these mines, I mean, we see the modern day mine, these were just holes in the ground. I don't know if you ever heard of bell pits, where they sort of literally cut them down. They're very, very basic. I mean, in Kingsville, they did have more developed pits. And getting back to the liberties as well, there were lots of different arrangements, sometimes just a family, or perhaps two families, just dig down into the ground. Sometimes they would find it difficult to finance this, to somebody would buy the rights off of them or something, you know, and then get together. So there's big landowners, if you like, not landowners, big interests running several mines and developing them, and captures the fruits and cubism principles. And there was the smaller holdings, the ones I'm more interested in. And we can see evidence here, like, you know, all this is, and it's just a hole in the ground. You can see the blood working there. The coal's come up, and it's a lot deeper than that. This is what's known as the pit head. And up here, they're bringing the coal, and they're loading up the coal wagons. That'll be shipped into Bristol. Some of it will go to Bath, some of it will go onto the canal, and perhaps go into South Wales and such like before the big pits in South Wales. But also, we see on this picture here, it's a bit more well dressed, and he's probably buying in bulk at the pit head before it gets to market. Now, my very, very dangerous job, but I mean, that goes without saying, I suppose, but I believe it also brought together an essence of community. And I'm just going to talk about one disaster that happened in 1753. Basically, it was a medium-sized pit that was being worked, and somehow we don't actually know what happened, but water was struck, and the wall of the pit broke down, and the water was flooded through, and the vast majority of the miners were swept away, never to be found again. But four people, could you go on a little bit to where the different levels are? Here we go, back again, please, my mate. That's it. Right, so it could be some words. You can see people working at different levels here, and there's the highest seam up here. And what happens was, is some of the people, four, actually managed to get up here, and they got away from it. They stayed there for 8 days and 8 nights. Now, this is quite famous in Kingsville history because all the local mines stopped work and didn't work for 8 days, so they didn't get any money for 8 days while they stayed there and tried to get their comrades out. They would not leave them down there until they were certain they were dead. And 8 days down there, I mean, you can see that all they got is candles. You know, they've been pitch black. I mean, there's stories they actually ate a basket, it was a pannier basket made out of reed. They actually had to eat that, they had to drink their own urine and such like. The youngest down there was a 10-year-old boy. The oldest was a 73-year-old bloke. The last 73 at that point, actually, it was an amazing achievement. And eventually they lowered down the brazier that drew the black cloud. The black cloud is sort of like a gas that's sort of it noxious, but it is noxious. They also, they couldn't get down there from this through the black cloud. They got down there, they got their comrades up, and they had a big celebration. They collected together £25. And that is an astronomical amount for the welfare of these four people, because they've gone blind. They were in a dodgy state, actually. But not only with this community, there's also, you know, a sense of wider community as well. And as I've said about the 1670 riots, about the squatting men, you know, if they felt they were being done down, they would react with extreme violence at times. And the Barbican government, governable people, comes from a line of historian William Malcolmson, who wrote it in 1985. And I basically, this was a quote from the Methodists. I'll talk about Methodists in a minute. But the people in the forest have seen it as completely and utterly outside of normal society. But that was a two-sided sword as well, because the Kingswood miners felt that they had nothing to do with Bristol, the people of Bristol. Have anybody heard the turnpike? You obviously know tolls, and there's a big one on the Lincoln Bridge in there, trying to get out of the city. Similar thing. In the period I'm talking about, before the Highways Association or whatever, you know, local landowners, they had roads going through their land. They used to put up toll gates for the purpose, basically, of raising money to keep the roads up to scratch, up to standards. It didn't always work like that, always to pocket it. But these toll gates were put up on the roads from Kingsford into Bristol and also into Bath. Now, the Kingsford miners would have to pay to get into Bristol. So therefore, they didn't make a lot of money, even though it was a very dangerous, dirty, horrible job, you know. They didn't get a lot of money out of it. So any extra on their overheads, with taking the coal into Bristol, would have affected them negatively. It was only a penny, but if you're taking several loads of coal over the week into, that's going to really knock it off. So in 1729, there was large turnpike lights. And basically, there would be a booth. On one side, there'd be, depending on the area, a couple of people in there. There'd be a barrier, sort of a chain or something across the road. When somebody came up, they'd pay the money, up go the barrier, in they went. The Kingsford miners attacked these toll gates, built a big bonfire, set fire, went up again. The authorities rebuilt them, they did it again and again and again. Now, they were successful because in the end, they stopped trying to put turnpikes on the road from Kingsford to Bristol. And also, after these events in 1729, the state actually made a capital offence, therefore they hang you by the neck for destroying the turnpike. So therefore, I think that proves, by the effect of the state, that their actions was actually successful. But unfortunately, they weren't always successful. As I said, there's different sort of types of mine. And some of the big mine owners, who brought together a lot of little mines, brought them out, employed the labourers and such like, and in 1738 tried to drive down wages to make themselves more competitive with some of the smaller mines. And obviously what they would here with what they would do if they'd force down the wages, they'd be able to sell their coal cheaper, they'd undercut the smaller mines, therefore forcing the smaller mines out of business, and therefore they'd have to sell up or just leave it, and the bigger mine owners would bring them into their fold, if you like. So what the miners did, and this is one of the biggest rights in the 18th century, in the country, not just in Bristol, in the country, the Kingsford miners all got up, they went to these unpopular pits, where the mine owners were put down the wages. They broke the pits, wired the machines, and this cost a lot of money, there's a lot of capitalist money in this. And they just made sure all the other miners were down below ground, were up. And then they threw all the machinery down, therefore destroying that pit for a good many years. Because not only could they not get coal up, they were able to get down there somehow and clear all the rubble out before they could even work the seams again. And then, amusingly enough, they then went onto the main road to Bristol and set up the Romans' whole gang. And everybody went on strike. So they set up a strike front to the toll gates. They could leave out the capsules books, if you like, you know. Word has it that they let a common person pass, but anybody with a horse or a bit of wealth, they were taxed populaire, I think the French called it. This was working, but they felt they had to increase the strikes. They moved to Bustleton, as it was called then, now Brislington, which is another coal field, just south of the sea, because Kingsford is east, small things, north south, and they started going around the mines there, and started encouraging their comrades there to lay down their tunnels and join in with strike. Some of the miners at Bustleton did, some didn't, and they had to have a little, shall we say, a little bit of encouragement, a little bit of physical encouragement to downstairs, to get up and come in. And then they marched into Bristol, and on the way they thought they'd visit a few outhouses just to, you know, have a little drink, a bit of Dutch courage, we call it in England. And as they did this, they basically went to each outhouse, and it wasn't very nice to the landlord or landlady, you know, they bundled into the kitchen, ate everything that wasn't nailed down, drunk everything, and then went to the next one. And at the end of the day, they actually went into Bristol, or in the centre of Bristol, for one day. They controlled the streets for all intents and purposes,
the local authorities withdrew, and eventually they withdrew, and they were partly successful. And a lot of the mine owners withdrew their ideas on cutting wages, and there was a sense of unease and calm. There's three types of rights, actually. I should have said this at the beginning. There's three types of rights that are very prominent in British history of this period of time. The turnpike rights being one of them. The other one being sort of early proto-industrial sort of wage disputes and stuff like this. But the other one is what E.P. Thompson calls the moral economy. And this is what I'm going to speak about next. This is price rights, if you like, bread, potatoes, that sort of thing. There's a lot of history in England of, and it was mainly women, which is very interesting, I think, would go into a market, they would go up to a baker that just put their prices up, seize loads of bread, sell it at what they would perceive as being a fair price, which was more than likely the price that was before, and then return the empty sacks that held the bread back to the proprietor and give him at that time some money back. So it's quite an organised right in that way, but it was sort of saying, that's enough, we're not paying any more. And this happened in Bristol on several occasions. But in 1740, there was a big dearth, it was the end of the Seven Years' War, cool, stuff like that. And there was starvation in England. And the Kingswood miners decided that enough was enough. And they were going to walk into Bristol and lower the price of bread by force. Now, have you all heard of the Methodists? Charles Wesley and all that? Yes, well, they all over Kingswood like a plague at this time. They arrived in 1738. Now, the thing about Wesleyanism, or Methodism, was they were very prominent, weren't they, in sort of the developing world. They sent missionaries out, well, out here, actually. Not quite. But Africa and other sort of places. But one of the places they really concentrated on in England was Kingswood. They felt that was the perfect place to take their word, you know, that God loves us all. There's a story of... it's funny enough, it's a West Indian cricket club now, but Rose Green, there's this hill by Kingswood, and Charles Wesley was meant to have spoken on there in 1739 to 20,000 people without a public address system. I find that a bit dubious. There were stories of when he told the miners that Jesus loves them at all as well, of like streaks of with the tears of going through their cold dust faces. But there's both sides of that. I mean, there's certainly... I don't know if you read E.P. Thompson's Making English Working Class. In there he argues that perhaps Methodism sort of hived off the revolutionary spirit of the working class in this period of time. And unfortunately there's evidence of this in the 1740 bread riots. Because a whole host of the king... Everybody down-tools, the whole area just down-tools and started marching into Bristol. And Wesley headed them off with some of the Methodists. Spoke to them, encouraged them not to riot, that it was against God's word, and he took a deputation to meet the mayor, and the deputation was made up of like older men, women, so they didn't look sort of too violent, if you like, took the sting out of it. They went into the mayor's chambers, doffed their caps, explained that their families were starving, the price of bread had forced them into this position, and they wanted him to do something. He promised them faithfully that he would do them proud, he would see them good, and they went back to the forest, and he didn't do a great deal. I mean, there was a bit of paternalism after that, you know, they set up soup kitchens, there was collections and such like, and one of the things I found absolutely amazing is one of the things they did do is they sent coal back into Kingswood, which speaks volumes in a way, because a lot of people must have lost that mode of production to the larger scale capitalists, and were bringing it into Bristol, and it had to come back out. In 1753, there was another period of dearth, and once again the Kingswood colliers rose up, and this time they didn't listen to the Methodists. They thought, you know, it didn't work last time, our children are starving, and they're going in. But unfortunately, the local authorities were tipped off, and they were waiting for them, and six people were shot. There's stories of like, all the Kingswood colliers coming in at different gates, because Bristol at the time, even though after the Civil War the castle was blown up and all that, I don't know much about Bristol during the Civil War, but it used to be a walled city basically, but there were still several gates, the main thoroughfares into the city, and the Kingswood colliers once again went round to the south to talk to some of their comrades from the southern coalfields, and they marched in like this. And there's stories of the women with their aprons where they're gathering stones to come in to sort of smash the windows off the council house and such like. but the authorities have raised the hue and cry, and they're waiting for them with ball and musket and pick them off and run them off. And there was a couple of days of fighting, going backwards and forwards. Four colliers lost their life. And this is very interesting, actually, a very unpopular bloke. He was also involved in the wage dispute, but the feature was chasing the colliers with his gun. He got a little bit overexcited for himself, got carried away. And they caught him, they disarmed him, and they took him back and held him hostage. They didn't hurt him. You know, they could have really done him grief. And he wasn't popular, he wasn't a nice bloke by any stretch of imagination for our side of things. But they let him go. They didn't pay a ransom, they let him go, and they hoped that would also show that their cause was right, if you like. They'd been forced into this violent confrontation with the local authorities, and they needed to be fed. Once again, not a great deal happened out of it, but one thing that I did think was very important was 29 people got taken to assizes, and writing in this day and age was a one-way ticket to the hangman's noose. But all 29 were, some of them were acquitted, but the majority of them were acquitted, but not a single one of them were hung. Some of them were transported for 7 years. Probably to America, actually, but that's it. That's about all I'm going to say now about the rights, but there's one other one I'm going to wind up with, a funny one. And that's one of the darkest ideas of all the state have ever had in this period. They thought they'd have this cyber tax. They were trying once again, I mean, you know what it's like with taxation, they get themselves in some stupid war or something, they can't afford to pay for it. They expect us not to pay for it by taxing what we enjoy. And I don't know if any of you have been to the West Country, but we like our cider. You know, it's a big thing as well. And like also the agricultural tradition around harvest time, you do the harvest and then you'd have a pint, so you'd be part paid with cider. I spoke earlier about the one-day house, you know, you'd be building a house, they'd be quaffing cider at the time, you know. In other cities in England, it was more like small beer or such like that. So it's very important. And they put this tax in it, which basically meant that it would price out the common man out of his favourite tipple. And they sent these customs and excise officers up to Kingsford. They must not have read the small print on where they were going to, but it was the daftest job they'd ever tried to do. And the Kingsford colliers greeted them cordially, lowered them down the pit, and promised to let them back up again when they stopped being so silly. And after a short period of time, they promised not to be so silly, so they brought them back up again, charged them for bed and breakfast, and sent them on their merry way. And 3 years later, the cyber tax was dropped. The back of the Kingsford Colliers and the Kingsford Forest, unfortunately, was broken after the Napoleonic War. There was a big war was in Europe. But at the end of it, in 1815, the British Army was demobilised. As I said earlier, Bristol was a big area for the armaments industry, so there was a lot of push-pull factors, like a lot of people were getting laid off, and at the same time, a lot of fit soldiers were coming back looking for work. So there was a lot of trouble in Bristol and lots of other cities within England. But one of the things that happened was the Kingsford Colliers, and also there was a very important criminal gang that I'd like to speak about another day, but not today, unfortunately, called the Cock Road Gang, that were basically a very, very organised criminal gang that had links in London, right up as far as Hereford, Cheltenham, all over the place, where there were steel horses and such like. And then once again, they were on lineage terms. But the authorities got together and they brought together the Kingsford Association, which was basically a militia based on the ruling classes, you know. They got the militia from other parts of Bristol, and civil war occurred up in the Kingsford Forest from 1817 to 1822, basically. A lot of people were killed. It was in line with the poacher disputes. They would break into people's houses on the basis of accusing them of poaching, looking for guns and nets and snares. A lot of people were transported, and the area, I would like to say pacified, but things changed. Shortly after that, the new poor law was brought in. And one of the saddest points is, like, anybody who was going to seek the poor law in Kingsford had to wear, like, a red cross on their chest, you know, so everybody knew they were going to seek the poor law, and they were shamed into it. At the same time, schools were being built up there for the promotion of Christian knowledge, in other words, work-life discipline. And also, there was the workhouses up there, as I said, and churches started to mushroom, not just the Wesleyans and such like. And another thing, like with the shipbuilding and such like, it wasn't really a forest, it was a forest only in name. A lot of it was very urbanised, as it is now. If you saw Kingston Forest now, you'd be very lucky to find a tree, actually. Mm-hmm. You know. But I think that's all I'm going to say, but I'm more than happy to answer any questions if there are any.
I have a question. Well, I was just going to ask, because like I'm really excited you're here presenting, but because I don't really have much of a knowledge of how much of this is known in Bristol.
Very good.
Yeah, I could you just discuss that?
Yes. I mean, that's part of the random history tradition.
I know that's part of
the hidden histories.
Yeah.
One of our comrades, she's also a trade union comrade, she works at Central Reference Library. And you ring her up and you say you want a book, and like you turn up, she's got 12, and she's very helpful. And you go through the newspapers, it's on microfilms and newspapers and such like, which is very much the ruling class perception of it. But also there was documenters, there was a Reverend Ellicott, for example, and he was there in the 19th century, he got press cuttings from the time, also got squatters lists and such like, that's held at the Bristol Records Office. And that's a good start. And like you just got to dig. It takes a lot of time. I mean, I remember I had this bright idea. I got this idea that there's a family of canes, C-A-I-N-E-S, Mark of Canes, and I'm a book that's probably going to come out soon about the Cock Road Gang. And I thought, I wonder if there's still some living in Kingsford. So I went to the phone book, opened it up, and there's canes everywhere. You know, so the family's still there. But there's a Kingsford Historical Association. They don't really talk about the writing or anything like that. You know, it's very one-sided. I talked about Malcolmson earlier. He's about the only historian who's done anything on the Kingsford Mine. Well, he started the Kingsford Mine, something like. They've popped up in other books since. You know, but it takes some digging.
Bob Malcolmson, right?
Pardon?
Bob Malcolmson.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, in Canada.
Is it Canada?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yes.
Who made the sentence?
Pardon me?
Who made the sentence?
I'm not too sure where these come from, actually. These all come from, get back to Dawn Dyer at the Central Reference Library. She got these, and she also got the copyrights on Grocer's Knot. She also sorted out the copyrights for this as well. They come from old sketches from the time. And I have to be honest, most of these are sort of more early 19th century, as opposed to some other. The bell bits are more common. The reason he's gone is because you stick on to the next one. This is French. This is complete with a black, I'm afraid. But it does show the different levels. You know, where you see the housing up there, they come down, you know, he's working a bit there, he's working a bit there, they're putting up. This is quite a larger mine and such like. So what I'm trying to say is what I've got here has been cobbled together from a lot of different sources about general mining, if you like, but I've tacked onto Kingsford mines to give us a rough idea of what it could have been like. You know, once again, going back to the disaster, you can picture, you know, if the water was hit here, it'd be seconds. And this stuff, about it. You know, the only open guys to make earthquake. But there is quite a bit, I mean, there's a big South Wales coalfields, and there's a big coalfields up north, and I think a lot more history has been written about mining, early mining up there. But the Kingsford miners are free miners now, but there's a pamphlet at the back actually about the Forest of Dean, about the free miners are there. And that's once again is another forest, but very similar to what I'm talking about here, where literally you can squat the land over a period of time, you can claim common rights, and you just dug down until you hit coal. And when you passed on, your sons are.
Steve, thank you very much for. A really fantastic presentation.
Thank you.
Very, very lively,
good.
Filled with spirit. Made it all alive again, you know, alive.
Yeah.
Really, really great. And but since I was in Bristol last, something has occurred to me about the Kingswood miners. It's not far from Somerset, is that right?
That's a good point.
It's in Somerset.
That's
and yet the levels there, eh?
Yeah.
Now, I was reading. Because here in America, we're very exercised about the origins of the earth and whether God did it or whether it came some other way. And, you know, Darwin and the geologists, they have their theory, but then a lot of people in the States, they know God did it like that. But I think those coal miners, they knew something because they were going under into the ground. And I think they were the in a way, I'm speaking a bit broadly now, they were the scientists who found the, might have found the fossils, eh? And then who begin to teach the first underground geologists of England. You know, the first underground map was 1801 of the different... but I think that this must have occurred to miners, right? Long before it did to the scientists. So I just wanted to ask, you know, as you're doing your investigations, to bear in mind that in addition to struggling against inhumane conditions, these people were going, you know, into the devil's underground and seeing it and finding seashells or finding, you know, the evidence of creatures from different horizons of the history of the Earth itself.
My understanding was that actually happened in South Wales. I don't have found any evidence in Bristol. I have heard, I'm not sure where I've heard it, I'd like to put a hand up for it, but I can't, unfortunately, that South Wales miners did actually find some stuff and did call geologists in, you know, for them to explain to the miners what's in there as well. But it's funny about what you said about the bowels of the earth as well. I mean, that was something else that was felt by the Bristolians and the wider community, because they were digging in hell. You know, they were going right down into the bowels of the earth, and that couldn't be good. That couldn't be good for you, no way about it. It's also interesting, Peter, that about Somerset and Gloucester as well, and I get back to the criminal gangs and such like, is Kingswood, is bridges Somerset, Gloucester, and of course the city and county of Bristol, because we have a chart in 1343 that make this group not unique, but there's only about three or four cities, I think, in Britain that is a county and a city. So basically what they could do is they could get up to no good in Somerset and quickly jot over the border to Gloucestershire, and the authorities in Somerset and Gloucestershire and Bristol didn't go with each other. And like there was no sort of jurisdiction. So that also helped, especially in the later period in the struggle, for them to sort of nip across the border. And that also made the area quite infamous. I'm sorry, I don't know much about the seashells and all that, but I will keep the eyes open for it. Roger.
Yeah, I just wanted to say in a sycophantic kind of way that this point's really interesting because when we were doing work on enclosure in 2008, one of the things we did was to go to a free mine in the Forest of Dean. So if you look on this map, this is another area which has free mining rights, just up there and sort of across the Severn Estuary. What was really interesting, so this is like, there is, as Steve mentioned, there's still free mines existing. So, for example, we went to this mine, and there's a 72-year-old miner and his brothers and friends who still, you know, dug this mine themselves. And when I say a free mine, it's like you do have a right. If you were born, you have to be born in the Forest of Dean, in this area, and you also have to work for 1 year and a day in a mine. And then once you've done that, you can dig a mine. You can just literally go into the Forest of Dean and dig a mine, which is very strange. So those common rights still exist. So we went to this mine, and this is 72-year-old bloke takes us down into this pit, right? So we're all wandering down and we've got our little hats on. But what came across to me, and this is what ties up with what Peter's saying, is I was amazed by the absolute complexity of knowledge and technology that these miners knew about. Okay, so we walked down the tunnel, and it's like all these different bits of iron and wood, and they all had different names you've never heard of in your life. So it was like, you know, I can't even remember all the names now, but there were so many different bits of technology they were talking about. They knew exactly how to work, because actually mines start to close up when you build them. So floors lift, and you know, all these techniques for dealing with those things, for dealing with gases, for dealing with water, and they literally every hour talking in technology. And it came across straight away that these weren't people who had been trained in any way by any kind of, you know, they didn't work for the National Coal Board, they didn't work prior to privatisation. They hadn't come through that background at all. They'd come through traditions of digging these mines for hundreds of years. And the technology was deeply complex. It was like, I mean, I just thought we'd just dig a hole. I mean, Steve's also saying there's no hole. But that was developed. That technology was developed for a process of actually learning and death and injury and all sorts of other things. It was incredible knowledge, right? And it worked. I mean, they were able to dig these mines without heavy machinery. You know, they were still deep mines as well. it seems. And what I think the point is, what we're making is that through that knowledge, the process of digging stuff, they would have come across things like fossils, or they would have understood things like stratification, rocks, like folding, and all sorts of other things. They had their own words for that, and they had their own way of understanding that, which may not have been the same as scientists, but it's absolutely true. The scientists would have been people, they would have gone straight.
What about that?
Yeah. I have a lot of questions, but one of them is more maybe will help orient all of us possibly, because you gave a kind of overview of a history that you're looking into, and I'm curious what part of it, right, is most resonant for you in terms of thinking about the present, you know, in terms of
I have to realize I do a lot about social crime, about the law and where it came from, so like, you know, going back to William the Bastard and all that, you know, how our rights have been usurped over a period of time, and lost contact with land, commons and stuff like that. But it came from Kingswood. I mean, Kingswood was one of the first things that tickled my fancy, if you like. And that's, because I'm a Londoner, but I moved to Bristol now. And I read about them, got involved. As I said, I went to the records office and such like, so they just sprung up on me. I'm also interested in writing, actually, a bit of civil disobedience. I've always gone for soul around here. You know, the moral economy and stuff like that, you know. But I think that's, for me, that's one of the big things. Over a period of time, you know, the time wage capitalism and such like, the way we've lost contact with our land, the enclosure acts and such like, moved into the factories, you know, the industrialisation, the mechanisation of our labour, and how the threshing machine could have meant that we'd only do a 2-day week. But in fact, what we do is lots of people lose their jobs and one person does a 5-day week, you know. It doesn't make anything easier for us, all it makes us more money for the capitalists, you know. That sort of process ongoing. And it's how we address that. Another thing I'm really interested in is the English Revolution, you know, where the start of printing presses, when people started to read the Bible for themselves, if you like, you know. I mean, I'm not religious in any respect, I'm an atheist, but like, at that time you had to understand that, you know, the Bible was the big book, it was the book, and people started to read it, and it said that the earth was a common treasury, it should be held for all, and they started to question the ruling classes and their rights to hold this. That sort of stuff is what really floats my boat. Makes me inside, it's to the left there. You're very good today. Yeah, that's something that really interests me. And I do think it has a direct link with what we've got at the moment. I mean, some of the things that Mr. Radical History have done, we were speaking last night, we held a seminar on the miners' strike, and then we had another seminar afterwards about coal, cars and climate, and about clean coal and the technology around it, you know. And we juxtapose those. So I suppose that's one of the ways you can bring it into the future, if you like. Another one is the enclosures and the pamphlet at the back about brewing your own beer from nettles. You know, because the enclosure acts, they industrialised, they started to grow hops, made beer as we know it now. When in the old days, we sort of got stuff from the fields, from the commons, made beer ourselves. And there'd been a cottage industry where somebody would have made the beer, we would all sat around and drunk the beer. You know, it's alienation labour, stuff like that. So I'm going on now. Anything else, please? Okay, thank you very much. Oh, sorry, there's one more.
I just have a question that I'm interested in this idea of the moral economy too, and just something that you're talking to me to think about is how I've got to believe there's like a much different relationship with debt and with the threat of the hangman in the context you're talking about than like how we think about debt and like the fear of dying today. And I just wonder if you have any like thoughts you've come across, or if you have any like ideas about what that risk meant to like a miner or to a coal miner.
One of our next projects is, there's a lot of riots in English history where the rioters dress up as women. And I'm going to answer your question by the going. And we believe there's several reasons, and Roger and I are going to work on this in the future. The Luddites, for example, the Rebecca riots, and there were times that the Kingswood miners were dressed up as women as well. There's a whole thing about the carnival, you know, coming out, you know, fancy dress riot, if you like. Some people think it might be that. Other people might have thought that, you know, around the moral economy, that the women used to go out as well. You know, it was like supporting the femininity of the domestic. I'm not too sure about that. I think another reason is the militia, would find it very difficult to fire on women. Oh, sorry, there was disguise. Disguise was another one, sorry. But the militia would find it very difficult to fire on women. So therefore, if they all dressed in women's clothes, the militia might fire higher. Now, what was the force in hanging? I mean, we've done some work on hanging as well, and there's some people that stand on the scaffold and make brave speeches around poaching and such like, saying, you know, I wouldn't be here if I could feed my family. You know, and it is basic as that, you know. I either watch my kids die, or I get out there and do something about it. And at the end of the day, you know, it's a horrible death hang, you know, other than burning perhaps, so you know, I can't think of a worse way, you know. So, I think at the end of the day, it was a deterrent. Oh, there's another, actually, it's very interesting. Tyburn, where they used to have the hangings in London, yeah, a big area outside Newgate Jail. And I used to pull them out there, and it was a big public spectacle. I expect most of you were regularly Michel Foucault, the public spectacle and such like, you know. And they'd hang pickpockets, for example. You know, people used to come up and nick it out of pockets. Now, it used to get big crowds, all sorts of people. There'd be ragamuffins selling apples and such like, you know. But there'd be the great and powerful come there to see the great unwashed getting their just desserts as they saw it getting hung. But there was large instances of pickpocketing. You know, so there's someone being hung up there as a deterrent for having their pockets picked. And at the same time, the rich were getting their pockets picked. So it obviously wasn't that much of a deterrent. I mean, there's also other things where there was riots at hangings. And there was also riots after hangings, because sometimes the dead were handed over to surgeons. A lot of our medical knowledge now is gathered from the medical profession who took the cadavers after the hanging, opened them up. And like, you know, if your mate has just been hung, you didn't want to hand over to the surgeon, because there's issues about the soul and such like. I'm going to jump a little bit to the pillory as well. Do you know the pillory, the stocks?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Thank you. What was pure information? The stocks, yeah. So you stick your head in like this, and like, I mean, sometimes it gets really nasty. There's an incident in 1822 when a thief taker, which basically is a bailiff or a deputy you used to have in America, was in the pillory, and they threw all sorts of things, like dead dogs, cats, bricks. You could die in the pillory. There's also other types, I mean, like suspicious pamphleters, or printers who were printed, like Thomas Paine or something like that, would have the books burnt in front of them, and then they'd be put in the pillory. There's evidence of the crowds having the collection, and clapping them. And the authorities didn't like that. And that was one of the main reasons they stopped public hangings, was because at times it could get a bit dodgy. You know what I mean? It was hard for them. Okay? Thank you very much indeed for listening to me. Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Right, do you want a break or do you want me to start?
Democratic.
Anyone want a break?
I want a break off.
Steve wants a break.
I'll just hammer on with the next one. So if you want to pick it up.
Excuse me.
5 minutes,
I can make some more coffee.
Okay, yeah. Right. Just have 5 minutes, yeah.